Hello, welcome to episode 19 of Coffee with Centuro. Past few months have flown by. This is our last episode before Christmas, joined by Ben and Siraj as ever. Morning, guys.
Morning. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah and all of the other greetings.
Yes, you too.
Happy Hanukkah. Merry Christmas. All right. So let's get started. We're going to start with the news roundup as we usually do. So let's talk about South Africa. Siraj, this is your area of expertise.
Okay,
we're going to talk about a new brand new airline that has just been launched in South Africa, and it's called Lyft. So it launched yesterday. Oh, Wednesday, sorry. Today's Friday. Today's Friday, 11th of December. This will probably go out on Monday next week. But on Wednesday, a new airline, Lyft, launched, and they've got, it's only domestic, so they're operating three routes between Johannesburg, Cape Town, and a town called George, which I've not heard of before.
Is it George?
And given that the pandemic is still in full swing, I mean, lots of countries are facing second waves. Airline industry has been hit hard. Apparently, air traffic has been down by 78% this year compared to last year. And TUI, which is Europe's largest holiday company, they reported, again, just there's been a lot happening this week, but they've reported this week that they suffered £2.7 billion in losses this year. And they don't expect anything to get back to normal until 2022 at the earliest. So I want to get your thoughts, both of you. Is this a crazy move to set up an airline, or is it actually the best time to start an airline?
So, yeah, I mean, I think just for from a South African context, if I can put it, is that we've been under pressure already. We've got a few kind of budget airlines around. We have a national carrier, South African Airways, that is under, it makes billions of losses every single year. It becomes a big political thing that the taxpayers to bail out the national airline on a regular basis. So this is, yeah, I think it's a ballsy move, but I think it's, I know the CEO that's starting it out. So Gidon Novik starting it out. And I worked with him when he actually ran the first low-cost airlines called Kalula in South Africa. So he introduced it, he built it up, and then he left to do something else. I used to publish the in-flight magazine for Kalula when he was still there. And I back him. He's an absolutely brilliant businessman. And he's again come in and he's doing it kind of very edgy. The guy, they're breaking all the usual kind of rules. In the same way that he did with Kalula, everything was very funny. All the announcement was done funny. Everyone wore bright green and it was quite... They at one stage, they had someone in drag as their lead. It's like a massive guy in drag as their maitre d', or what do you call that, the chief cabin person, and he was just so funny. So that was Kalula, and I think they're doing this very different again. The food's all served by Vida, which is South Africa's Starbucks. You know, they're the cool coffee brand that's everywhere. So it's interesting that they've come in, and I think at a time where the sentiment is just not to use the South African Airways and their equivalent low cost airline Mango. So there's a bit of politics involved, but just generally, sometimes in a crisis, I think it's a good time to launch.
Yeah, I would have gone with maybe the best time to try. I think one of the problems with the existing airlines and all their losses surely has to be, you know, legacy systems and processes and overhead, right? So they've got this massive company. It's very difficult to pivot and to come in on a budget and be aggressive, I imagine. So if you're starting off new, you can be disruptive, you can put things in place that reduce your costs and reduce your overhead. That they don't have, I'm sure they would have adjusted their plans, but, you know, existing airlines will have had so many things rented, so many contracts in place that will just weigh them down, whereas Lyft can come in and do it intentionally in this period of time so they can plan out their costs, they can plan out their operations in a way that will thrive off the back of this. And by the sounds of it, there's a lot of other good timing elements to it. But yeah, I reckon it's a good time to start getting in because soon people will have to start getting back. So you want to capture that market. Like when else will there have been such disrupt where the whole market's basically been tossed up in the air, and then it's just going to be a free-for-all for who can sort of catch it again. So it's a good opportunity, I think, to get everybody. Everybody's got a chance to refresh their brand biases and so forth. So I think, smart move.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. With all the literally every airline has suffered. They're all saddled with debt because they've had to borrow loads to prop themselves up. And you like legacy systems, exactly like you just said, Ben. I mean, it's the perfect time to beat the competition. You can come in, bring in new policies, be lean. Leasing planes is now much cheaper than it was this time last year. Fuel prices are a third cheaper now than they were this time last year. So if anything, you're coming in, lower costs. Competition are all struggling. You can come kind of sweep in, and with the vaccine as well, let's see, you know, maybe travel will get back to normal. It will still take a bit of time, obviously, but maybe it'll get to normal, back to normal quicker than initially thought. So yeah, let's keep an eye on that one.
Especially with domestic, I think we've all seen that domestic travel is the way to go. So it's a good shout to start there.
All right, we'll watch them closely, see if the gamble pays off. Okay, let's move on into a slightly different field, leaving aviation and moving into, I don't know, hospitality tech. I don't know what it's called, prop tech maybe. Airbnb. So Airbnb went public yesterday. Or they were looking to go public, and they went public yesterday. And they were looking to raise $3.5 billion by listing their shares, which kind of gave them a stock market valuation of $47.3 billion. Went public yesterday. By the end of the day, can you have a guess how much their actual valuation was?
I did see that they raised their initial price expectations by about $10 a share. I don't know what that translates to the new number.
Did it go up? Because sometimes these things, they come in at a point and then they dip really badly. So I was actually going to go the other way and say perhaps that happened again. They came in and then it dipped.
You go down 10 billion, Siraj, I'll go up 10 billion.
Okay, good.
All right, so 37 and 57 billion. So they gave themselves this valuation, 47 odd billion. By the end of the day, valuation, over $100 billion. Oh. And I'm going to put this into context. In April, they were backed by private equity because they were struggling from the pandemic. At that point, private equity put in $1 billion, which gave them a valuation of 18 billion. So April to December, they've gone from 18 billion to 100 billion during a global pandemic when they've clearly been struggling. So what I wanted to know is, do you guys think this is a realistic valuation? Is this stupidly high? What does the future hold for Airbnb?
Isn't it a realistic evaluation is kind of like an oxymoron, right? Because is it ever realistic? I find it most Silicon Valley kind of evaluations just absurd. I think it's overvalued, but at the same time, what an amazing time. Look, it's again this exactly the same thing, which is I think we said it when we started out these programs. We were speaking about people taking advantage of the crisis and the fact that you can actually make a real win. And this is one of those things that might go down in the history books of something that really worked in to their favor, because they dipped and then they went straight back up when people realized, well, then I'll just holiday locally.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the keys. And, you know, there's been a few crazy valuations and IPOs and so forth this year. It's been quite an interesting time. But I think what's unique is obviously one element is Airbnb is profitable. And like to say that while we're still in a pandemic and have gone through it is a crazy big tick in their favor of all these other companies at the moment that are IPOing and, you know, Uber still loses millions and they're worth how much? I'm not sure. I think Tesla, part of one of their jumps was based off reaching some level of profitability, but you know that their stocks went out when they were still unprofitable, but Airbnb is coming out at that time and they've managed to sort of pivot and capture enough of the market that I think everyone's just like, yeah, let's get in on this. It's if they can make hospitality work in a global pandemic, then what's it going to do as soon as there's no pandemic? Like, they're profitable now. Once we can travel again, it's only going to go further up, right? So I can understand. I mean, we're in a big period of hype, sort of carries a lot of things along a fair way. So I understand where the hype's coming from. Whether or not it then, you know, averages back out to somewhere between that 47 and 100 billion, who knows? Maybe because it's worth 100 billion now, everyone else jumps on. It might go up again before it drops.
Yeah, I think it's grossly overvalued personally. I was going to say, I mean, they have pivoted. They've done really well. So one of the statements their CEO made was, you know, we're great. You know, students have been using us because they don't want to go home to their parents, and people who want to self-isolate, or some people want to work remotely but don't want to work from home. They've been using Airbnb. But that doesn't really seem sustainable, nor does it seem enough for you to think. So, yeah, they were profitable in 2019. I think that was the first year they were profitable. Doubt they were profitable this year, not 100% sure on that one, but if they were, that would be amazing. But either way, I mean, there's a lot of controversy with Airbnb even before the pandemic happened. So cities like Lisbon, Barcelona, a few other European cities have actually threatened to ban Airbnb because they're saying that, you know, it hurts locals in terms of rent prices, there's other safety security issues. And I know Airbnb have battled with all of these issues for, you know, 10 plus years to get where they are today. And I think it's a great business, but I don't know, 100 billion when they were valued at 18 in April and during the pandemic, that has to come down to hype. That's the thing with stock markets. It's what everyone says around it, the confidence, and I don't know, it's crazy.
Yeah. The problem is often that it's people that don't know what they're doing that jump on the hype, get it up to 100. The people that know what they're doing will jump out now, and then the numbers will crash, and it'll be the people who don't know what they're doing that'll, when it goes back to 47 or 20 million, well, it'll be higher than the 18 billion in April, but say it just goes back to their expectations. Once it loses half their value, unfortunately, a bunch of people lose out there, but.
Yeah, it really is swings and roundabouts, because whoever's kind of buying it at 98 or whatever, as it's increasing, they're overpaying, especially if it's going to bounce back. But the irony, I mean, of this is that it's the biggest accommodation business in the world that owns zero rooms, right? It really is. You mentioned it as you entered, whether it's a you know, tech prop. I mean, for me, this is like 100% a tech thing, because you know, I'm busy trying to put together a conference in Turkey for May next year, and the two biggest hotels, which is the Crown Plaza and the Hilton, are both closed, and they have been closed for weeks now. Just what is the cost of a massive building like that standing empty for months and months on end, versus, you know, Airbnb? Yes, they lost, but all they do is they pull back a little bit. They haven't lost a thing because they don't own any of the property. I think it's still genius. You know, it's pure genius when it comes to, let's rent out someone else's thing and make money off. Just think.
You could argue it only works when you have those properties, and if you know, people have second property. If people are sharing out a room in their own home with COVID, do you want strangers coming in and out? Number one. Number two, are strangers even coming in and out because of the lack of travel? And then if you have a second property, given the pandemic and the uncertainty and the less numbers of people traveling, is it better to rent out the whole property to a family or to a group of people rather than use Airbnb? So at that point, does the model fall down anyway?
So my I don't have a property. My sister owns a home close to George. You mentioned that airport, so it is a holiday kind of space. And she used to do it on Airbnb, and then this year she went for long-term rental. So exactly that. But when I spoke to her, she said, well, she prefer to go back to Airbnb because she can make a much better profit margin on it and then have the place available for her to use when it's not booked. I still think as I think both Uber and Airbnb started out, the initial concept was use your own car while you and make some money off it, and use a spare bedroom and make some money off it. And then it just becomes commercialized and people buy properties to Airbnb or cars to Uber. And it becomes a different beast. You know, if you look at the amount of properties on there and what they've got right, which is the ease of use and everything else and the trust and all of that. And again, Airbnb has become a the name, right? We'll Airbnb it. Even if you book something on, or you go to another place to have a holiday for the weekend, we Airbnb it, you know? So
yeah.
I think they've done amazingly well. And sorry, last thing is, I think I mentioned it in a previous episode, is that on a podcast with the founders of Airbnb, when the pandemic happened, they cut back their marketing spend by $1 billion. And you don't think of a tech platform spending that amount of money on marketing. But it does, you don't become a brand name like Airbnb without that. So they are pumping huge amounts of money. It's not by chance that they are as big and that they are valued at that. Having said that, $100 billion.
He seems to have frozen up.
The statement that he froze. Computer couldn't handle that number.
Well, let's hope he reconnects. But it's a good point on the marketing, because from a PR perspective, Airbnb have been in the news pretty much all year. So even though people are saying, "Oh, you know, the numbers have gone down by 80% at the beginning of the pandemic," just the fact that people are aware of them and it's an option, staycations, the rest of it. So that's probably helped. Okay, let's. Let's move on, and hopefully Siraj can hear us or comes back. but as you mentioned, Tesla. Oh, there we go. Is he coming? There he is.
I'm back. Sorry about that.
There's the cute sound internet.
There you go. Sorry about it.
No worries. But we're going to move swiftly on to similar themes. So Ben mentioned Tesla earlier, and sticking to hype and confidence and people commenting on the stock markets. We're going to move on to Tesla. So, on Wednesday, again, everything seemed to happen on Wednesday this week, JP Morgan released a report warning investors that Tesla shares are grossly, dramatically overvalued. And by the end of that day...
We all know that already.
We all knew that already, but as soon as somebody puts it in a report, especially if I'm from JP Morgan, by the end of the day, Tesla's shares were down by 7%, which, if we look at Elon Musk alone, his net worth was... He lost $9 billion, basically. And I guess we should all be really feel really bad for him, because it left his net worth at just $136 billion. But my point was, again, so with Airbnb we had the hype, their valuation goes up. With Tesla, some bunch of people write a report, publish it, suddenly the price drops. I mean, what do you guys think about the fact that just a comment or, you know, a report can have such a big impact on stock markets? And do you think Tesla will bounce back from this? Is it a problem?
Yeah, I think on some level it's needed, right? Because it needs to balance out that hype. As I said, the problem is people get FOMO, they get the fear of missing out on the crazy numbers and so forth. So they buy in without really doing enough research. So you kind of need something official, like a report from JP Morgan, like you said. It's like, we might have known it was overvalued, but until someone commits to it, then a bunch of people are going to go, oh, better drop out. And I think it's part of that correction. So, yeah, I imagine we need it. I guess it's just to be expected. I mean, 7% in the grand scheme of how much they've grown in the last 18 months is not that big of a dip, I don't think, really. So I think if you're on the Tesla ride, you stick to it and you assume it's going to keep going.
Yeah, I think these guys, you know, we've often, can you imagine, I doubt Elon Musk or Bezos look at the too much at their bank balance or at their net worth as we do, right? We are absolutely fixated by the fact that the guy lost $9 billion. But imagine you were him and you did that. You'd be a nervous wreck, because it would be doing this and you'd be like, I'm losing, I'm winning, I'm losing. I think they look at it in quarters. They look at it in a longer stint. And to ask you a question on whether they'll bounce back or how it's going, I think a Tesla is just so, everything is coming together for them in that the movement to be electronic, and the movement to the whole view of the global pandemic, not global panic, like global heating, global warming and things, and the fact that we need to get away from carbon vehicles, petrol vehicles. I think there's so much going for them that there's more than hype with them. So there's the fundamentals of a good business is actually there, whereas whereas the others are, the slight fluctuations are expected, but the fundamentals of what makes an actual viable long-term business success, I think Tesla's got it spot on. Also because for a couple of months, or now probably years ago, Elon Musk, they opened up all of their technology to the patents and all of that. Everyone could copy them, but he had already by then set up a become the supplier of the best batteries in the world, and he's just banking on the overall industry to go up. So he's kind of got, he's got this thing where I'll lose over here and I'll lose over here and I'll win over there. So it's kind of going up and down. I think they've got the fundamentals of it, and I'm not just saying that because he's a South African.
Obviously, I don't know him, but I think you make a good point there. That the way he works isn't always. He does, I doubt he does look at these share prices, or maybe he does. Maybe people talk about it, but I don't think he's fussed. So I remember reading. I could be wrong on the specific facts because I saw it on social media, and you can't trust everything you see. But apparently, when he sold PayPal or his shares in PayPal back in the day, he put all of it into his next venture. He put all of his money into Tesla. He was like renting a one bed or whatever, you know, eating his beans, even though he's suddenly become a multimillionaire. All of that money straight into the next venture. It's not about the money. It's about the objective, about his company, about what he wants to achieve. So yeah, I think you're right. He's probably not personally too fussed about that. And plus, it is net worth. This money isn't in his bank account. You know, the share prices go up and down. One day you're the second richest person in the world. 2 days later, you could be the fifth. I mean, first world problems as well, not even first world, the 0.1% problems.
it's not bad. Yeah, he's put his money across SpaceX and Tesla, and I can't remember if that was the third or not, but yeah, that's sort of known for doing. The market's also really interestingly consolidating. So back to the sort of report effect. A little while ago, there was a bunch of hype around Nikola Motors, which were making a semi-truck fully automated and so forth, and it blew up and everyone was buying stocks in it and so forth. Then they had a big multi-billion dollar deal with General Motors, who would then start sort of building it. But then a report came out. It was one of the organizations that have to go and actually look into your business, and they eventually, to paraphrase, went, wait, this company's full of BS. They basically don't have anything, you know, they're faking it till they make it kind of thing. And then GM ended up pulling out, and I think that's like, I haven't checked where it's gone since, but like it's crashing. So these sort of things happen, especially around big hyped up stuff.
So moving on to big companies, rich people, hyped up stuff. We won't spend too long on this, but Facebook, we discussed them not that long ago, maybe a month, maybe more than that, where we were speculating, you know, will they be forced to break up WhatsApp, Instagram, all the other things they've bought? Is it too big? So we've had this discussion before, but I just wanted to mention it because Facebook are facing a US antitrust lawsuit. 46 states got together, only 4 states opted out to kind of challenge Facebook on this. Zuckerberg's response was, this is ridiculous. Every time we did an acquisition, we were vetted and everything was looked at by the competition authorities. Why are you now historically looking back because of our success? So I know we've discussed it a little bit before, but now it's actually happening. We were purely speculating. We got it right. Any initial thoughts, quick thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know how I would feel because I guess from Zuckerberg's point of view, they did all the right thing. People laughed at them when they tried to pay $1 billion for Instagram, and then when they paid $17 billion or whatever the number was for WhatsApp, everyone were like, that was a ridiculous acquisition for that amount of money, and it was crazy, and why would you do that? And yeah, they went through all the correct channels and had it approved by the SCA, I think it is. And then historically, for people to go, oh, actually now the cool thing is to pick on the big tech companies, you go, well, we're the ones that took the risk, and you know, Instagram was probably not going to survive this long if we didn't buy it and make it what it was. So to say we were buying up our competition or, you know, becoming too big of a conglomerate, it's just the success of our company. So I can imagine that's annoying, but I guess at the same point, there is a reason why they eventually break up two bigger companies and that have a monopoly. So yeah, it's an interesting one because if I put myself on that seat and we just built a really amazing, massive company, did everything correctly, and then the government came back 10 years later and said, you did too good a job. Go split your company up. Like, what are you going to do to that? So I kind of get both sides, and I just wonder, how you would feel if you did too good a job building a massive company.
It feels like a punishment for success, which is bizarre. But I've thought about the fact that what does breaking up mean? I somehow think these guys will sell it for a profit. So they're actually just going to make more money, right? They'll just take off assets that they think are probably the weakest, sell it for a lot more than they bought it for, and then continue. But I still, it's for me, I'm kind of still questioning what's the overall, like, who gains by this breaking up? Do they really feel that Facebook, because of the lack of competition, is just bullying the price higher of all their assets? And if so, do they think it's going to really change if they sell it? Because the kind of people that are going to buy this or want to run it are going to want to run it at similar kind of prices. I don't know. I think they'll still make a success out of it, even if they sell it.
I think it's a power thing.
Yeah,
I think, like, if you look at, so why did Facebook buy Instagram? Because everybody was moving towards Instagram and sharing photos there rather than posting them on Facebook. Why did they buy WhatsApp? Because everybody was messaging on WhatsApp, and Facebook were like, we have Facebook Messenger. We want that to be the thing. If Facebook now owns everything, they own everyone's data, their monetization comes from advertising. They're making a killing off Instagram adverts, Facebook ads, controlling that, fake news. There's all these different issues. And I think they've had so many challenges from US authorities in various ways this year. And this is just the next one along the ladder, because the motivation for Facebook to buy these companies in the first place was to beat the competition, which is anti-competitive. So the other question is, why was this not picked up during those acquisitions at the time?
Yeah, I think that comes back to people not realizing that Instagram was worth $1 billion or so forth at the time. So it's the people sitting there making the decision not understanding what a social media photo app would be worth. And I think to Siraj's point, the thing is breaking up the power of having those elements. So once you start creating profiles based off people's Instagram combined with their Facebook, combined with their WhatsApp data, the information you have at your fingertips versus if all of a sudden WhatsApp is its own company, they're on that scale, right? Is its own company, and then you have to start having data deals and so forth. There, one, it becomes more expensive. At one point, you own all the data. At the other point, someone else owns it, and then you've got to come up with contracts and so forth that cover how you use that data, which will change the user agreements as well. So I think it is just that control, and data is king information. So they'll have crazy profiles based off what I looked at on Instagram and then went over onto Facebook, and the cross advertising and so forth as well. I think that's what they're trying to cut the ties between. So, stay in your lane, you can get as big as you want within there. But once you start owning out this data and this data and this data, you become too powerful, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's it. Zuckerberg is now the overlord of the world in terms of data. So that kind of brings me on. He is clearly a very smart man, a bit of a genius possibly, who knows, depends whether you like him or hate him. You can't deny that he's a smart guy. So there was a report released this week by a company called VoucherCloud, which ranked the top 25 countries in the world based on intelligence. So what do? They looked at, they had kind of three main criteria that they looked at. So one of them was the number of Nobel Prizes each country has won. That represents historic intelligence. They look at the current average IQ of a nation, and they look at kind of education attainment. Now, I dug a little bit into this, but I couldn't really figure out what they meant by education attainment, but essentially it's to do with schooling, so school grades, exams, degrees.
A big number of degrees people have or something.
Yeah, so a combination of like high school and university level kind of educational attainment. So with those three kind of criteria in mind, they've created this list, 25 countries. If you guys had to guess, who's number one? I love asking you to guess.
Yeah, it's good. If I hadn't looked it up from knowing we were going to potentially discuss this, I would have wondered if the US would be high just from, I assume they must have calculated per capita on the Nobel Prizes. So, you know, you would just assume based off the sheer number of people, they might be higher in that, but I don't know. Although going off degrees and so forth, I would maybe go over to somewhere like Switzerland, just because I think they have a pretty high number of, like, most people speak three languages and have 2 degrees or something like that. So I would probably have gone somewhere like that.
So I didn't kind of look it up. And, you know, the patriarch in me is going to say South Africa. But I don't know if we're even in the top 25, to be honest. I'm going to go with the unspectacular Germany as number one.
Interesting choice. So Germany, I'm looking at the list right now, is number 12. Switzerland is number 2. So that was a good guess from Ben, even though he's already looked it up. number one.
That's the one I honestly didn't see the rest of the list.
You already saw the first one. So the first one is Japan, which, to be honest, I'm not surprised about. Obviously a highly developed nation. Back at least, you know, maybe 10 years ago, they were always known as the top place for tech before tech took over the rest of the world. So it's interesting because a lot of Asian countries are on this list and European countries, but I don't know if this is the best measure for what makes the smartest nation. One, can you even rank an entire nation? Two, Nobel Prizes, that was kind of a Western creation anyway. So more US European countries are likely to have them. It's probably changed over time, but still historically. And then average IQ, I mean, when was the last time any of you guys took an IQ test? Was it an official?
I must have seen a different list actually, because I saw Singapore as the top.
Singapore is top 4 for IQ.
Yeah, okay, that might have been what I saw. And yeah, that was going to be my question. Like, I don't know what my IQ is, so where are they getting these average IQs from? I do imagine, obviously, to stereotypically, Asian countries tend to do very well with their schooling and so forth. So that's not a massive surprise. But yeah, I'm wondering. That's an interesting one. And like you said, Nobel Prizes.
So, I mean, the US is number one for Nobel Prizes. The UK is number 2. UK is number 17 for average IQ, and it's not even on the list for school achievement. Yet they managed to come in at number 8 in the world. So I don't know.
Isn't it interesting how, if we looked, and it, I know it's a long time, but 50 years or Japan was kind of nowhere, you know? LinkedIn have these interesting, or I see it on LinkedIn, but the interesting kind of little videos with the bar graphs that move side to side through time, whether it's the size of the company or brand worth or anything like that. But if you look at Japan's kind of growth, and even China to that extent, but Japan, I think just after World War II, because I think that with all of the political and Pearl Harbor and all the else, Japan was like really, like, nobody wanted to touch Japan from a business point of view. And even, you know, when they started building cars or they're building different things, they have done things progressively really well, and they've grown it as they go along. I think Toyota, you know, has become kind of something about reliability, and it's a trusted brand where you go there. I feel South Korea is doing something similar in that Hyundai and Hyundai, Kia, LG, Samsung, all of these brands a couple of years ago were just kind of, you wouldn't touch it with a barge pole, and now they're actually competing with the top. I just feel they're in for the long haul and they do things really well. I haven't been to Japan, but it's one of those places where it's starting to intrigue me more and more. Maybe I'll go to the Olympics 2020 in 2021. Who knows? No, but I don't know. They've just seemed to be doing things really well. And I think it's not a bad vote for my side of things.
Yeah, amazing.
I think these things are always interesting talking point for 10 minutes, and then I sort of move on with my day sort of thing. Not to say we can talk about this more than 10 minutes, and I didn't want to talk about it in a second, but I think that's just where almost to our point on the data, it's like, yeah, well, if you count it this way, then cool. You know, well, cool that Japan's up there. There's all these interesting things going on as well. I just quickly checked out myself and we're down around 15th, I think, or something like that.
18th. It's just bitter. So Australia's 18th, UK's 8th, yeah. South Africa's not even on the list.
Sorry, I'm
being deep. That's all right. Back to school, Suraj. Come on. Yeah, help out.
These lists are always arbitrary. It's like,
yeah.
But whilst we're talking about intelligence, it's kind of a nice segue into the next topic. So people reportedly always say there's a particular game, maybe you want to call it a sport, probably not, which requires a lot of intelligence, and that's chess. And there's also a saying that, you know, the best leaders play chess whilst everyone else is playing checkers. And Suraj, I know you're keen to talk about this. Not queen, there you go.
You know, and I've only watched the first episode of Queen's Gambit. I'm not sure if, Zen, you said you've watched the whole series.
I've watched the whole thing. I thought it was a really great show. I mean, if someone had said to you, do you want to watch a show about a girl playing chess in the 60s? You'd be like, well, not really. But it's a really good show.
But I'm fascinated by the effect of it, in the fact that how powerful Netflix has become based on just how they can influence different things. So I don't know if you've got some of the stats there, or I also do, but on what it's done to the game of chess, just directly based on the year-on-year averages of things around this show came out, right? Have you got it? You're gonna run with it,
or I'll let, no? You shoot the stats.
So some of the games company called Goliath Games says it's increased year-on-year chess sales by 1,000%. Google's saying how to play chess is at its near the highest it's ever been on this as a search criteria, and books on how to play chess has risen by 600%. I mean, it's just phenomenal how one program can do that. And then it kind of goes again to this the power of influence and the power of things around what we're watching these days. And I don't know if we, you know, the strength of social media, of streaming, of all of these various things, has it ever been that powerful where there's one kind of network that is that can influence globally, besides sport that kind of goes globally?
I'd probably say not. It's just, I'd like to see the amount of people bring on. So like Zane said, you know, your average person, if you said, hey, are you interested in watching a show? Would just be is obviously the hype around it makes people want to watch it for fear of follow the bit. I have watched it yet.
We're not really getting anything, so hopefully the internet will sort itself out. But I'm just going to develop on that point. So I think popular culture has always shaped society. So what people are interested in, what they want to do, what's cool, what's not cool. And here's a good point that now, has there ever been a company like Netflix that's done that? Because, I mean, if we look at chess specifically, when I was at school, so when I was a kid, I think I was 3-4 years old, my dad taught me how to play chess, but I think he wasn't really that into it either. We just knew how to move the pieces. We'd play each other a little bit, never really got into it. And then at school, the kids who went to chess club, it was always, you know, there were certain kids who would think, oh, that's so nerdy, why would you join chess club? And it was almost taboo, like, you don't want to join that because then you get picked on. Whereas now you're saying all these stats, everything's shot up because of the TV show. The Queen's Gambit was number one on Netflix in 63 countries. So it's clearly had mass appeal. So who knows, in like 3-4 years, 2 years, even this year, maybe chess club is the place to be. And that all comes down to popular culture. It all just comes down to popular culture and what opinions are and how you can make something look cool.
Yeah, amazing. I saw another stat that Netflix says 80% of what people watch is based on recommendations. So as much as their kind of thing says, because you like this, watch this and all of that, 80% is actually coming from recommendations of kind of chatting amongst your friends. It's again one of those very powerful word of mouth things, because I would never have done that. But my son, who actually is, I've got an older son who plays chess. He told me, you got to watch this program. And I was like, really? And I watched it and I thought it's a really good production value and all the rest and interesting. And so again, yeah, 80% of what people watch come from recommendations. And then I thought about that. And I do it with my mates and every now and then. It's one of those things that you kind of, around a barbecue kind of go, what are you watching these days? You know, and you start talking about the series that you're watching, or you recommend things to your little group of family or whatever, you really should watch this documentary or things. So, yeah, I think you're spot on, Zane, in that the new popular culture can be shaped by these things.
Yeah, hopefully I'm coming through a little bit better. Just quickly on that, the first thing that came to my mind with what else does things like this was like MTV, maybe back in the day, would define popular culture based off what people were watching, and like where you would like stick to a channel and that was the cool kids channel to watch. And then like when you were younger, it was the cartoon channel or something that you watched, and that would then inform what toys and stuff you know, everyone wanted to have. And the other thing I find interesting about this and the way this does is, are these chess companies then going to expect these sales next year? I think is an interesting thing to look at, because I think it will be a fad. I don't think chess will be cool in 3 to 4 years. Sorry, Zane. And don't get me wrong, I was along there with you in primary school. We had a really good teacher who taught us the entire class how to play, and the thing became to can you beat the teacher? So we'd literally sit in at lunch, and if he had time to play with us, and try to beat him. And that would be the thing, is how many times have you won against him in the year? But yeah, I think it'll be a fad. I think people will fall off. One chess, and what's one of the reasons I fall off from it sometimes, you need someone else to play with you to be able to play at any sort of consistency and so forth, and at the same level as you is the other trick. But yeah, I'm really interested to think these companies have 1,000% increase in their sales. You're their sales team, and then they're going to be like, cool, we made this amount of money this year. I want a 10% increase. Like, well, no, we're going to have a 990% decrease. Because the Queen Gambit doesn't come around twice. So I even saw, these things happen. On YouTube, one of the top creators there, PewDiePie, has a running just in joke with his videos that he has a tambourine. And then there was the thing saying the tambourine sales went up 15% just because he has an in joke with it. And I had the same thought with that. I'm like, these guys must either, one, not know what's going on, or two, once they figure out what's going on, they're going to be like, How do we keep making this sort of money? Hopefully they're smart enough to just go, all right, we'll ride this wave, but next year, like, it's...
Have a $100 billion valuation this year.
Sell the company at 1,000% increase for $1 billion, and then...
But that's a good point that you both make. So on the recommendation point, Netflix itself recommends things to you. So... like, I watch Queen's Gambit because I open up Netflix and it said number one show in the UK today, Queen's Gambit. I'm like, what's this? You read the description. I'm like, all right, let's give it a go. It's the number one show everybody's watching. Or I ignored it the first few times, and every time you open it up, it's still there. You're like, well, all right, let's see what the fuss is about. But then the point on chess kind of going away next year, I think the thing with it specifically as a game, it's so complicated. If you really want to master it, you kind of have to study it. You have to read the books, or I don't know, maybe there are videos nowadays, and kind of look at the strategy, play with other people, learn from each other. And it probably takes a lot of time investment to get good at it. And it's one of those sorts of things where if you're a kid, you're either really into it or you're not. You'd rather be playing, some of them would rather be playing football or doing so many other things. So it's not the sort of game that is going to have mass appeal. So even all these people that are into it now, they're going to get into it, read those books or watch those videos, and then they'll get bored after a couple of months and be back to something else. So it's a good point.
I wonder what happened, because there was a fad at one stage where Master Chefs, was it big? I mean, I know there's Master Chefs Australia, there's Master Chef UK, there's the great cook-off or bake-off or whatever it is in the UK, and it became such a big thing. But I think that also influenced the amount of people who thought cooking was cool. And I know that within my family, my brother-in-law is just because I think following on watching that kind of show, just got interested in cooking, and then it kind of grew and everything else. So there are probably other shows that became, that have influenced popular culture as well. Probably not the last that it's going to happen. And just interesting that, yeah, I wonder how many chess sets will be under the Christmas tree this year versus sorry, my teenage son, we couldn't get, you know, PlayStation 5 or whatever.
Yeah,
and it's magnetic. It won't fall off. Oh no, that's gonna go down. You know?
Could be the other way around. Sorry, son, couldn't get your chess set, but I got your PS5 instead. Oh dang it! Yeah,
download the chess game on the PS5 instead.
Okay.
All right, great. I think that's gonna wrap us up today. So that was our last episode before Christmas. So as we said at the beginning, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Christmas. We hope all our viewers have a great break. And
by the way, we didn't comment on your jumper. I feel
National Christmas Day, Christmas Jumper Day when we're recording this. So got my Star Wars themed just to make it a little fun. I guess also worth saying that we'll obviously be coming back next year, and we're looking at potentially mixing up the format. So if anyone wants to suggest anything, please feel free to shout out. But I think come January, we'll be back with everybody in video and podcast format and so forth, and hopefully bring a few changes. So this is the end of season one. Might even come up with a new name for season two. On that. Yeah. Happy holidays, everyone.
Yeah,
you too. Happy holidays. Thanks. See ya.
Yeah.